From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. All great social movements for change have been infused with artistic expression. The art of movements reflect the issues, causes, and impacts with a clarity that speeches and statistics simply cannot. The civil rights movement had song, the Black Power movement had visual art, the feminist movement had poetry, the Chicano movement had murals, the American Indian movement had film. Chronicling and analyzing the art of protest in a new book is my guest, T.V. Reid, the Buchanan Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Washington State University. His recent books include Digitized Lives, Culture, Power, and Social Change in the Internet Era. He joins me to discuss his book, The Art of Protest, Culture and Activism from the Civil Rights Movement to the Present. Welcome to the program, T.V.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, of course, I simplified it when I said that the civil rights movement had song. It had more than just song, but song is one of the, music is one of the things that jumps out most when we look back in retrospect on those cultural and artistic expressions that really beautifully emphasized what the civil rights movement was all about. And that's where your book starts. Why does it start there with that civil rights movement?
It starts for several reasons. First of all, the civil rights movement was in many ways the paradigm setter. It set the model for a whole bunch of progressive movements over the next 7 or 8 decades. So it was a logical place to begin. And also, in terms of its movement culture, it had one of the most developed, most effective, most magnificent movement cultures of any movement ever. And that, of course, as you pointed out, is primarily through music. And what I tried to do in the book is to pair an art form and a music movement in each chapter. To start with, the music was really important to make a couple of points. The first really important one is that culture works best when it's adapted rather than created whole scale for a movement. In the case of the civil rights movement, a long, deep tradition of Black spirituals, folk songs, and eventually, more recently, other kinds of musical forms were very much a part of the culture. So when you added the content, the new content of civil rights struggle to those older songs, it seemed familiar. It was easier transition into coming into ideology and the ideas and the power of the movement.
Just broadly speaking, before we go to the other movements and their art, how do you view the art of protest in terms of making the movements more effective? Is it that art is a tool that movements use to become more effective, or any good movement naturally has amazing artistic expression, you know, by virtue of how human beings interact and organize?
Well, I think more the second. I think I don't like the idea of art merely being an instrument of protest, because I think it's more than that. I think what I tried to do in the book was to, in the title itself gives this away, the art of protest means two things. It means that all protest needs to be artful in the sense of thoughtful, emotionally, strategic, and carefully and creatively done. And secondly, that the arts themselves, the whole range of arts we've already talked about, painting, music, puppetry, murals, all those things contribute specifically to a movement. And movements at their best draw upon the traditions of the cultures that they're working with and expand those in ways that make sense to bring about social change. So it's a natural development in a sense, but not in the sense that it just happens automatically. It happens through the work of hundreds and hundreds of cultural workers who adapt the existing cultural forms to the new kind of work being done by the movement.
It seems to me that it is both organic and purposeful, right? The sort of proliferation of art of a movement.
Exactly. And again, it's best when it's those two things together. It's very hard to create a culture. You have to have, you already are living in one or living in many very different kinds of
cultures. You can't fake it. Yeah.
You can't fake it and you shouldn't. And so you need to develop it organically. But again, organically, with a sense of the specific needs of the movement at a given time, the different kinds of constituencies who have different artistic tastes, different interests, and the kind of people who bring to movements. Artists are drawn to movements perhaps more than almost anyone because they tend to be the most thoughtful, emotionally rich people in the world, and they understand the power of change through culture, and they really can bring to a movement something no one else can bring.
Let's talk about the Black Power movement, which you follow up with in the second chapter of your book, The Art of Protest. And you end with the Black Lives Matter movement, which is, of course, a contemporary movement today, seeing both of those movements as part of a spectrum. But the Black Power movement had a sort of wonderful visual element in the form of the kinds of posters, art that we saw during that movement, but also a theatricality, right? The Black Panther Party in particular, which embody the Black Power movement. We remember the berets, we remember the rifles, we remember the powerful stances of the men and women and their sunglasses, right? And their afros.
Right. Yeah, a sense of style was extremely important. And imagery is always important to movements. And the Black Power movement, and the Panthers in particular, projected a sense of power in the very way they dressed, their leather, the berets. They seemed like a very powerful force, even when they were starting out as a very small number of people. So, and as they developed this kind of theatrical things. They started out, their most famous action in the kind of burst them onto the public scene was at the California State Capitol in Sacramento when Reagan was governor. And they basically marched into the state house armed with rifles in their beautiful black uniforms and berets. And they basically demanded their Second Amendment rights to carry arms. And it was incredibly theatrical. It was covered by all the news media that had up to that point ignored them. And it made a very strong statement about the complexities of the Second Amendment, which has primarily been used by the right for very different purposes than what the Panthers were trying to argue for in terms of their ability to defend themselves in their communities against police brutality and against other kinds of racism.
So the Black Lives Matter movement, which of course is a very young movement still, how does it build on the past, on the movements that came before it? And what are some artistic expressions that we see today? And this is, of course, the age of the internet.
Right.
And therefore, it's a hashtag.
Right. Yes. Well, it's a hashtag movement. It started as a hashtag, as you know. I would say that in many ways, they're a critique of, as well as a use of, the black radical tradition. And in particular, you'll remember that the movement was started by queer black women, primarily, and that had a very important, already built-in critique against the kind of masculinism that was the downfall, from my point of view, of the Panthers. The Panthers' use of theatricality was great until they got taken too literally, and many of them died. And their violence was initially self-defense. They called themselves the Black Panther Party for self-defense. That idea got lost rather quickly, and they became easily associated with a kind of terrorism that made them much easier for the police to repress them and kill them. Black Lives Matter has been more clever about that, I think, though there have been times when they've fallen into the violent, what I call the violence trap. But mostly they've been very clear that a movement has to be dealing not merely with race, but gender and class, sexual orientations of all kinds. And they've had a much more rich tradition to draw upon in music, and that's primarily been rap music, where there are a variety of great rap artists who have contributed directly to the movement, some of them well-known, some of them less well-known. But it's itself a kind of dramatic art form, one that works very well in the internet age, since you can share it as memes, you can share it as entire, rap videos and so forth. So they've drawn very, very fully on that, and they've done it in both a very popular way with big major artists like Beyonce and Kendrick Lamar. And they've also done it in more smaller ways, like some of the artists who were actually the relatives of some of the murdered young men and women that the Black Lives Matter movement is protesting against. They also have done rap songs that are more personal, more direct.
Let's move to the feminist movement. And I should point out, your book isn't chronological, it's more thematic. So we go now back in time to the feminist movement and the poets that came out of the women poets that came out of the feminist movement, and the incredible writings that and poetic writings that came out of it. You single out This Bridge Called My Back by Sherry Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa. How seminal was that book, and how does it illustrate the importance of poetry as artistic expression of the feminist movement?
Right. Well, as you know, the history of the women's movement is very complex, including complex around issues of race. So This Bridge Called My Back was a moment when women of color who had been involved in the movement forever, but nevertheless were underrepresented in both poetry and in public image in general. And so that wonderful book of poetry and essays and short stories really opened up the fact that women of color were very much at the center rather than the margins of the women's movement. And their beautiful poetry from every major community of color, every major orientation of you know, sex and gender there, that I think really expanded the movement away from its perception that it was merely a white women's movement. So that was a really vital moment in the history of the feminist movement.
And then, of course, you have women like Adrienne Rich, and, of course, you have Toni Morrison. And it seems as though the poetic expressions of the feminist movement still continue to an extent today. Or is this a chapter that's sort of closing?
No, I don't think so. And again, we have new forms, too. I mean, you know, poetry is always very close to song. And in this case, it's also had been evolving to some extent to spoken word. Spoken word being, in some ways, getting back to the roots of poetry when it was originally an oral form, not a written form. So you have wonderful, you know, rap singers, female rap singers who were very much part of the women's movement. And you also have spoken word artists who are taking some of the same kinds of issues in a new context in the current moment. So I'd say that poetry in its classic form, as well as transformed into song and spoken word, very much alive right now in all these different strands of women's movements.
Let's turn to the Chicano movement and the murals of the Chicano movement. And for those of our radio listeners, I would love for you to see our interview on television and its television format, which you can see on our website at risingupwithsonali.com, because we'd love to show you some of the visuals as well. Why did the Chicano movement's artistic expression center on murals? How did that sort of naturally, organically become a powerful means of expression?
Sure. I think there are two major factors. One, there was a long and rich tradition of murals, particularly among Mexican artists, that is from Mexico as opposed to Mexican American. And the rich tradition of those people was very much a part of Chicano culture in the U.S. as well. There's also a history in the U.S. of Mexican muralists who worked in the United States, particularly in the 1930s. Diego Rivera, one of the major figures, was created a number of murals around the United States. And some of that was a very rich and powerful tradition. In addition, in many communities, in many barrios, there was already tradition of painted walls that had, there were various kinds of artistic and more commercial kinds of paintings in big art, big form on walls. So when the mural movement came, it could take its political message into a community that already understood what you might call the art of the mural or the art of wall painting. And so it was an easy transition, again, as you call it, an organic transition. So suddenly those walls that had been pictures of maybe the inside of a tavern now are pictures of Che Guevara or pictures of women struggling with the complexities of their identities in a movement that was, again, slightly male-dominated in the beginning. So you have a way of building on an existing tradition, but again, turning it in a new way to add the new content in the resistance movement to racism and so forth that the Chicanx movement was doing at the time.
And TV, you point out in your book that the UFW, the United Farm Workers in particular, used this art form very effectively in their organizing around farm workers, around the grape boycotts, and organizing in the farm towns of California.
That's right. And they had, they used a number of art forms. They're also, El Teatro Campesino also grew out of the farm workers movement. And that was extremely important. They did various kinds of theatrical presentations right on the, in the fields, right in the, on the strike lines that were very important, educating both the workers and those against whom they're protesting. But yes, murals were very important. The UFW Black Eagle flag was very much present everywhere in many of the murals as one of the figures that, again, expressed the new condition of resistance to racism, the resistance to the impoverishment that was brought about by racism, resistance to the horrible conditions in the fields that were undermining the health of workers. One of my favorite posters, murals, is in San Francisco called Las Lechugueras, which is about the lettuce pickers. And it actually shows a picture of a pregnant woman in the field. And you can see her unborn child in sort of a kind of X-ray vision inside her womb. And at the same time, you see a plane flying over and dropping pesticide onto the field. A very powerful expression of the ways in which racism can not only kill you in the present, but almost wipe out your future generations. And that kind of thing was in all kinds of forms through the murals of the 60s, 70s, and continuing today. Murals are very much a part of communities all around the country, not just Chicanx ones, but particularly Chicanx, Latinx ones, where it had this more organic connection.
And then you have the American Indian Movement, AIM, which became also around the same time, in the 60s, 70s, this powerful political movement for self-determination. And we see film being synonymous with this movement. But also, interestingly enough, of course, we have a very troubled relationship between Hollywood and the portrayal of Native Americans. So tell me a little bit about what you write in this chapter, Old Cowboys, New Indians.
Right. Yeah, of course, there's a long and horrifying tradition of the filmic representation of Native peoples, the old cowboy and Indian story, in which the cowboys are always the heroes, the Indians are the savage villains. So what in the American Indian movement, they tried to flip the script and to make the Native people the heroes. And in some ways, they did that in two different ways. One was through documentaries, which were more controlled by the movement or movement sympathetic people. The other, though, was a kind of infiltration of Hollywood, in which new films got made that were still, to some extent, the cowboy and Indian story, but they were twisted and turned by having Native characters in them who spoke back. And some of the mainstream films, Woman Warrior, Lakota Woman, those kind of films, they took off from a kind of constricted point of the whole history of cowboys and Indian stories, but they turned them in a new direction to express a contemporary resistance, because a lot of the stories of Indians are about the past, as if they died out rather than they were a very vital force. So they were able to turn those old cowboy and Indian stories into something new. But there are also limits to that, because very few of the actors were really had enough power to fully control the stories. So the stories were better, but not great. But they brought in some new messages of resistance, and some of the stories that AIM was telling worked their way into some of these more mainstream films in a kind of clever subversion.
I'm speaking with T.V. Reid about his book, The Art of Protest, Culture and Activism from the Civil Rights Movement to the Present. You have a very interesting chapter which drew my attention in your book. We are not the world, famine, apartheid, and the politics of rock music. And so we remember, those of us who were around in the 80s, remember the very bizarre, but perhaps well-meaning response from American and British sort of Western pop stars to the famine in various African countries. Of course, in looking at some of that art, that musical art, through today's lens, the music comes across as deeply patronizing and even racist, doesn't it?
yes. And again, that was even there from the beginning. And what I do in that chapter, I take the obvious examples of some pretty horribly, as you say, well-intentioned but deeply racist and suspect songs like We Are the World, which basically, you know, turn Africa into a kind of, you know, wave child that can be saved by the West, a terrible message to be giving. But those actions raised millions and millions of dollars, and they raised awareness about a problem that had been deeply hidden to most people in the developed or overdeveloped world, so I like to call it. So they played a role, and there were two ways you could respond. You could only respond by saying, oh, this is all racist nonsense, we shouldn't pay any attention to it, or you could again try to turn it to movements. And many, many movement activists around the world took that moment and they built on it in new ways. They built better songs, they built better stories out of that moment of opening that rather, you know, terrible but well-meaning series of events around the famine and the apartheid and other related events. And they turned it to something very much more aggressively political. And that was a kind of rescuing of a moment that could have just faded away into the worst kind of charity.
Right, because apparently people in Africa don't know it's Christmas. I want to turn to the protest art of ACT UP, a very, very powerful movement, and then try to wrap up our conversation about some of the lessons that we today can learn from the artistic expressions of some of these past movements. And of course, this is a primarily New York-based coalition fighting for the dignity and a cure for HIV/AIDS, and very, very powerfully standing up for the rights of LGBTQ Americans, and standing up to the terrible sort of bigotry and hatred coming out of the White House at that time, Ronald Reagan. Tell us about the art of ACT UP, simple and yet powerful art, visual art.
Exactly. I think that particularly it was graphic art. That's the focus of that chapter. Again, all movements, you know, work with more than one art form, but each chapter emphasizes a particular one so we can figure out what it does especially well. In the case of ACT UP, a lot of the ACT UP activists were either artists or they worked in the ad business, which is, of course, centered in New York, as is much of the art world. And so they had a lot of sophistication about the media. And one thing they realized very quickly was that the media likes brief messages, short and succinct, unlike the way I talk as a professor. So their graphic art was very much a straightforward, in some ways, very direct expression, but it often was also humorous, and I think humor is an incredibly important political force. And also they understood that sometimes you want your message not to be exactly clear, but to kind of draw you in. And the most famous example of that is their slogan, "Silence equals death," over a pink triangle. Now, the pink triangle was a symbol of the ways the Nazis killed millions and millions of people identified as non-normative sexualities. And they turned that up, that symbol of death, really upside down and made it a positive symbol. And they also, in that phrase, "silence equals death," they drew an audience in. What does that mean? And you want to know more. You want to figure out what that's about rather than simply saying, oh, I can dismiss the message or I know what they're talking about. You're intrigued. And so you can be more brought into a wider analysis, a deeper analysis. And in their case, they were working on a number of fronts. They were challenging the media, which was doing a terrible job of covering the HIV crisis. They challenged the government, which was ignoring it. They challenged the church, which in some ways was deepening the crisis by their sexual moralities. They challenged homophobia and racism, which, as I say in the book, are social diseases that were making the HIV crisis much worse than it had to be.
So finally, and we didn't even get to finish going through your whole book. There's much more to read. But I'd love to wrap up our conversation around where you think the art of our contemporary movements is at this moment. I mean, thinking about the messaging around ACT UP, I see so much relevance to, say, the politics of climate change and the activism around climate justice, right? I mean, we are facing an existential crisis. crisis on a mass scale, and people have been trying in vain to draw the attention of our lawmakers to this issue, and we have seen some progress, but not enough. Do you think we are as good at art as our predecessor movements were?
Sure. I mean, I want people to know that history, to draw from it, to learn from it. But I also think you always have to work from your present moment. Every situation, every historical moment is different. So I would not tell people what to think, what to do, how to build their art forms now, except to say that if anything, culture has become even more of an important ground of struggle than it was in the past. And I think that the trick is to make art that speaks clearly, that draws on emotional intelligence as well as cerebral intelligence, that is above all something different, because what's called protest fatigue has hit the media. They don't cover the same old marches and protests. They find them not sufficiently dramatic for their ratings battle. So you've got to be creative. You've got to find ways of doing that. And again, my book is full of thousands of examples of how you can do that. But do them with a new twist. Do them that bring you into the current moment, the current need, the current issues that face us. And none is more important than the issue of climate justice. Climate not simply as an issue that we all face, but one that we face unequally. That people of color, people in this global South, are much more likely to be and are being impacted more deeply than those of us with greater privilege. So yes, there's no more important issue than climate justice. The recent protests by young people were full of wonderful slogans, again, often very humorous as well as very intense and strong messages for the future. And again, the fact that young people are up in arms is extremely important. It's always been youth who are at the head of real social change. They've not yet been beaten down by history, by reality. They dream, they fight much more impassionately, frequently than the adults who've kind of gotten reduced to the horrible conditions that we are often facing. So,
well, well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, TV, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. Take care.
My guest has been TV Reed. He's the Buchanan Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Washington State University. And we've been discussing his latest book, The Art of Protest, Culture, and Activism from the Civil Rights Movement to the Present. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.